Welcome to the Caving Podcast. I'm your host, Matt Pelser of the Central Indiana Grotto. This is a podcast that's been going 5 years strong, and it is for cavers, yeah, sure, but also for you if you are interested in getting into caving. What is caving? Well, it's what some people call spelunking, although it's a whole thing with us. We say cavers rescue spelunkers. Spelunkers is like an amateur term for us, but it all means the same thing, entering a cave for the purpose of exploration or scientific endeavors or recreation. And we, with the NSS, the National Speleological Society, have a number of safety protocols that we kind of insist upon, and for very good reason, which is why you might have found, if you're just getting into it, that some cavers tend to be a little secretive. Well, it's because we don't want anybody to get hurt, which is easy to do if you don't know what you're doing. But if you do know how to do this the right way, it's pretty safe. And so what we try to do is we try to hook you up with people who have done it before. And usually all it takes is a few trips for you to get it down. And so we encourage you to get in touch with who would be your local grotto. What is a grotto? A grotto is a local chapter of the National Speleological Society. And I'll link you in the description of this podcast to a page on the NSS website where you can find your local grotto and get involved. And, of course, this podcast is sponsored by El Spelio, makers of some of the finest caving lights on the planet. If you are ready to make the big light upgrade that you deserve, El Spelio is ready to help make that happen. And you can go to elspelio.com and use promo code podcast to save $20 on any light or any order whatsoever over $300. And this past summer, I lent my top-of-the-line El Spelio Lunatic to Lane Roberts in Texas, who was just getting going on serious caving. She's a guide at Caverns of Sonora, show cave there. And she shared an update with me in October, and she's doing all kinds of stuff with that light. She's checking out some potential new caves in Texas, going to the High Quads in December, maybe a Mexico trip over Thanksgiving. Not sure if that's happening yet, but she's hopeful. So she's making good use out of that light, putting it through its paces, which I would not really be able to do because a father of toddlers don't really get to go nearly as often as someone who owns that light should. So I was happy to lend it to an up-and-coming caver in Lane Roberts. So, Lane, glad you're enjoying it. And if you are jealous of Lane and would like to use one yourself, just let me know. Send me an email, alpineproductions@gmail.com, and I'll get you on the list to maybe send it to once she gives it back to me. And again, for your own El Spelio, go to elspelio.com and enter the promo code podcast to save $20 off any light. No caving this past month, but went hiking in Red River Gorge. Did a 5 or 6 mile warm-up on a Friday, a couple of Fridays ago. And then a huge 18, almost 19-mile day on Saturday. And then a little leisurely hangover run on Sunday in Natural Bridge State Park, just across the highway from the gorge. So great time had by all. I'm glad we didn't camp. We would have gotten soaked on Saturday night. It did rain. Stayed in a cabin, had a hot tub, brought a bunch of beer. And now, as a man in my late 30s, that is, I think, how to do it. Oh, I'm still a fan of camping. And I'll be doing some camping this weekend, too. And I've got a first-timer's trip planned for Buckner in the middle of this month. And I'll let you know how that goes in December. Bunch of noobs who want to try it out. And I love facilitating those trips. And this month, I'm very excited to bring you Devra Heyer, who is the NSS Education Division Chief. She has a similar role with the National Cave and Karst Research Institute, NICRI. And I want to thank Matt Bowers once again for hooking me up with Devra. And she was such a great talk, as you're about to hear. Here is a delightful hour plus with Devra Heyer. So you got a lot going on then.
Yeah, it's great.
An awful lot going on.
Yeah, I miraculously grow forearms and, you know, especially when I'm cooking.
It doesn't really help when you're caving, though. You kind of need as few appendages as possible.
Not true. Yeah, with chasms, like, because you always need 3 points, and I end
that's
up.
That's true. If you're chinning,
so like, you know, your counterbalance definitely counts as 2 points of contact. At least mine does. Sometimes 3. I'm pretty sure there's a lot of photographic evidence that people are like, what is actually attaching you to the wall? And I look like I'm sleeping. there's like 30 feet of air below me.
Let me just start in a weird place.
Go for it.
Because I'm intrigued by day trips in Lechuguilla.
Oh, God.
So for the longest time, and I've only been introduced to this idea in the last, I want to say like year and a half or something like that, back when they were like looking at some kind of celebration at Lech.
The 50-year, I think, or something like that.
Something like that. Yeah, there you go.
I'm pretty sure it's the 50-year versus the 20, because like 80s is when Lech opened up.
Yeah, yeah.
But I think the digs started. And random side note, I was actually on an airplane. Someone saw me reading a book about caving. And they're like, yeah, I went into a cave. And I'm like, yeah. I'm like, awesome. And they're like, yeah, New Mexico is called I'm like, Lechuguilla? And they're like, yeah, they had just been digging. It was like the only cave they went into. They were in college. And it was at the point in time in the 80s when they were still digging, doing the dig. And they went, a girlfriend took them. And so crazy that this person is just like, that was like the only real caving they ever did. And they're telling me about going on this dig in this weird cave.
Did you fill them in as to all the progress that's been made since then? Did you nerd them out and freak them out a little bit?
Yeah, I did. They of course, they kind of understand. I'm like, yeah, just to let you know, if you watch Planet Earth, that's the same cave. And he's like, oh, that's so cool.
You should have stuck with it.
Everyone's got their bag, man. Like, they have the thing that drives them. And that was one of those, like, great little random intersection, you know, like, meetings.
Yeah.
It always happens, right?
Yeah. So, I mean, along those lines, I was always under the impression, you know, nowadays anyway, that if you're going to go into Lech, you got to commit to a week or whatever.
Yeah.
And that's typical, I guess. But there are day trips. What are you even accomplishing on a day trip? Why are you going in there for a day?
So it's a lot of the resurvey. So especially in the Glacier Bay area. So if you, I have to send you a picture so you can see the difference. So just kind of thinking about back when this started in the 80s, a lot of people, they were bagging Big Passage. And so that survey literally looks like two lines and some gypsum.
Yeah.
And the scale is just like, whatever, we're going to do like 50 feet per inch. There's no detail. And so you have like, there's a whole section that Kevin Manley did. And it was like, originally it was done. It was on one of those little pieces of survey paper that you get in your little yellow book. That's, what is that, 5x8?
Yeah.
And it didn't even take up the whole page. And he did it on those, it took two legal sheets when he was done with it. Part of it is Paul Berger is now the like survey mastermind behind that area. That's his cartography baby.
Yeah, yeah.
So he has a high standard of what he wants, especially in that area, since we also have that high accuracy survey in that area. So it's that whole area is being resurveyed. There's even some new passage of like things that are tiny and crawly that no one really like poked their head into. Because you know how it goes. If you're bagging Big Passage, are you going to really do the gypsum evil crawl tight, like Tai Chi-ness that is needed to kind of get to that breakdown mace?
Well, it's kind of a pain in the butt in there too, because it's so warm and it can be sharp too.
Okay. So you and I have very different standards of warm. I actually get cold in Lech.
Really?
I am the person that in Boulder Falls, while they're waiting for everyone to get down, will put on a jacket.
Well, I mean, I guess if you're hanging out for a little bit, that's one thing.
No.
But, you know, I mean, in Indiana, where everything's a little cooler, the idea of a 68-degree cave is just sounds to me like a bit of a nightmare.
I wear, like, leggings, shorts, and a long-sleeve shirt, maybe short-sleeve shirt, in Lech.
Yeah.
And everyone else is, like, down to their shorts.
Yeah, yeah.
and in my last job, I was working at Alma Pais, and those caves are like 34, 36 degrees. And
Fahrenheit?
I swore,
wow.
Yeah, Fahrenheit. And I swore I would never be in a cold cave. One of my friends, he always makes fun of me about like, I don't know what cold is. And then told him what the temperatures were in the lava tubes. He's like, oh, that's a proper cave. I can't do a British accent, but yeah, it's like,
yeah, that's a little closer to what I'm used to. Now that we've gone over that, let's go back to the beginning. Like, what was your, what's the genesis of your caving life? Where'd you get the bug?
So speaking of coming full circle, so I'm originally from Texas. So I went to Bastrop High School, and there was a guy there. His name's Wesley Schumacher, and he started caving in high school with his parents, well, mostly his mom. And I ran into him in college, and you know, Facebook had just come out, and he had taken these beautiful photos and posted them on Facebook of this like white gypsum crazy formations, and I was like, what is that? And I ran into him, you know, on the quad, and it was just like, so tell me about this caving. How do you do that? And he's like, oh, Devra, most caves don't look like that. I'm like, I don't care. I want to do that. And he's like, no. Like, they're all like, most of them are tight little holes in the ground. This is like a big special thing. It's like, I don't care. I know I could do that. How do I get in? And he told me about going to the UT Grotto. And at that time, no one was really doing anything. If they were doing more like going to Mexico big expeditions, which I couldn't do at that time. I wasn't quite ready. And there wasn't like beginner trips, but I like nagged everyone, did every single rope night. I like actually could do a pick off before I actually went into a cave.
Oh, right on. Well, there you go. You're well prepped.
But that was it. Like, so Wes actually helped haul camera equipment for Planet Earth into La Chiquilla.
Oh, wow.
And he had posted the photos online. And so I had no idea that that's what he had done. And so I basically like nagged everyone I could. Eventually, like, someone took pity on me and they're like, oh, there's a survey trip going. And the people that I was with didn't even realize that was technically my first cave.
Wow. Really?
And it was a survey trip. And they're like, oh, and they're like, well, there's this type part. And we're like in the back, we're starting the survey. And I'm like, where's that type part? And they were like, oh, it's way back there.
We just did it.
Yeah.
It was just, wow.
And they had no idea. I was like, I didn't know. And like, and I was like, and they're like, is this your first cave? I'm like, yeah. And they're like, oh, okay.
So wait, I'm sorry. Did we just, it was Lech?
No, my first cave was actually Cobb Cavern with
Cobb
Peter
Cavern.
Strauss and Gene Kretschup.
Okay.
So it was a survey trip into Cobb Cavern.
Oh, man. Okay. Vertical element on that?
Nope.
No, none.
Just a little muddy thing. It was really cute, really pretty.
Cool.
There used to be a show cave, and they were doing their, like, trying to figure out. So I actually don't remember. I remember, like, we got to collect bugs. That was my favorite part. So I got to collect bugs with Gene.
So it's always, from the get-go, it's always been kind of about survey and collect. Just the real work. The real work, yeah. And not just, I mean, the fun is sort of a byproduct.
Yeah. Well, actually, I find that fun. So
Right.
Technically can count how many times I've on my two hands. It's only recently been on, it used to be only on one hand, only recently been on two hands, like just kind of for fun, non-work trips.
Yeah. Okay.
my first just for fun trip was Honey Creek, going from entrance to entrance.
Okay. And what kind of trip is that?
Honey Creek. It's, 20 mile long cave. It's a couple hour swimming, basically. It's really fun. You just kind of get your pack to float, pop it behind your head and army tee the whole way.
Yeah.
So it's beautiful. It is epically beautiful water filled passage.
And how long does it take to go from one entrance to the other?
We did it in under 3 hours.
Oh, that's not too bad.
I think it's 2 miles of swimming, something like that.
Oh, man. That just sounds like a dream to me. Best trip I ever took. There was a long, they called part of it a bathtub, but really it was a stoop walk. But we were swimming and just floating on our Swago packs for a good way. It was like a backstroke.
That's the army tee.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Well, we called it something else. I can't even remember what it was, but yeah, yeah, yeah.
I used to teach swimming lessons, so like.
Oh, okay.
The chicken airplane soldier.
That's the elementary backstroke, because that's what I remember that being called. Yeah.
Yeah, I end up going into a lot of wet caves and get sandbagged. When I went into Fisher Ridge, I was with Steve Gladio. And he was like, yeah, the water only goes to my knees. I'm 5'1".
Oh, okay.
So it did only go to his knees. It went basically to my sternum.
Wow.
There's a height difference. I think there's a foot and a half difference between my height and his. There's some great pictures. Like same thing in Quintana Roo, of someone standing next to me and they're the water's at their waist and the water's at my chest. And I'm like, I am cold.
that your stature though has got to help you out in a lot of situations. Like I love caving and I will go anywhere I physically can fit. And I got no problem with that. But sometimes because of the length of my femur, and I am 6 foot yeah. two on the verge of 6 foot three, and I am all legs. And if I get my femur in the wrong place, it's bad news for me. So how often, I mean, you've got to use that to your advantage, right? I mean,
yeah, I do still not push as much as I can because there's that element of, okay, if anything does happen, no one's going to be able to get to me. I definitely remember one of my first expeditions, I was in China and we were pushing these sporting leads and I'm like, okay, there's this. I have to turn around. I'm going to go feet first. I'm not quite sure if I can fit, but you can get me out if I kind of get into this awkward position. They're like, oh, we can't even get to where you are right now. There's just no way. I'm like,
okay. Yeah.
This is problematic.
Yeah. Well, what was that like? What was China like? I mean, I know every expedition's different, but as I understand it, gosh, some of those caves in China are out there and you're committed to being out there in the wilderness for a good while.
So my first China trip was very unusual as a China expedition. So I'll start from the beginning. So I met Erin Lynch actually at ICS in Texas. And I actually met her through Erin Curtis. So it was one of those, they knew each other. And she's like, Erin, meet Erin type of deal. And I emailed her later going, oh, I really, 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 really want to go to China. Because I had seen so many presentations in my grotto of Jean Wen, she was talking about doing a kilometer of passage and these epic boreholes and these epic rappels. And I was just floored of the scale and the beauty. And
you're probably thinking this is going to be a hike underground with a little rope work.
Yeah. And what ended up happening is no one got back to me, and I was a teacher at the time, so I had the whole summer off. And I'm like, hey, here are the dates, I'm free, let me know, and no one got back to me. And then a month before I went, basically, Erin emailed me, and she was like, oh, Duncan was supposed to get a hold of you, that was, who is one of the other cavers who was living in China at the time, I'm going to be in Alaska. He will be there. So, and then it was this confusion and he got a hold of me. I'm so sorry. So I got my visa. I got my tickets. I got everything really last minute and spent a month in China. But instead of this being this big expedition, which is normally what happens, I usually do something over the summer, or spring break or Chinese New Year. It was Duncan, Collis, Rob Garrett, and me. That was
okay.
It.
Lean it group. Was, that's good, though.
It was three people. I think, I'm trying to remember if we, I can't, I have to look in my notes. So it was either 6 kilometers or 6 miles. I think it was 10 kilometers or 6 miles that we mapped through the whole entire month or something like
wow.
that.
Wow.
We actually did get, one of the days we actually got a kilometer that in one day. Most of the days we usually, in one day, yeah. Most of the days we did about 300 meters. So this is also what skews my day trips. Going back to Lech, kind of full circle, is those day trips are not 5-8 hour days. They're more 13 plus or minus hour days because you're doing 4 hours there, 3 to 4 hours there, 3 to 4 hours back, and at least 5 hours of survey.
Yeah, it's a full day.
It's a full day.
But it's still inside 24 hours. So.
It's still inside. Yes, exactly. So it's just these under 24 hour trips, not... And, as I said, the resurvey trips. So when I was doing these China trips, we were doing usually about 13 hour days. We went out in the morning, and then came back for, you know, for we were in time for tea and time for dinner. We did get locked into a cave that was, I think it was 150-foot tall entrance. We got locked in, which is another story.
Wow. Oh, that's
that we had a breakout. That was fun.
oh, no.
But yeah, so it was, some of it was a little bit of resurvey, but basically we were trying to do all the good leads that no one wanted to do. So we were pushing a bunch of leads that, because people want these epic borehole. I was more doing the little crazy Tai Chi passage that, you know, and one day it like popped into like 15 meters wide and 20 meters tall, blowing passage, can fly a kite in type of thing.
Oh, that's cool.
And then the guys are like, do you want to come back here today, tomorrow? And I'm like, no, let's actually push something else because this is perfect. And in fact, that area became where they did their first camp.
Wow. Okay.
Yeah. So I, like, you're right. It's huge. And honestly, after coming from Texas and Mexico and days of like walking in black, I was just like, I could use some walls. Walls sound comforting right now.
As opposed to just blackness. Yeah.
Yeah. It's just... And Jim Kennedy actually let me borrow a Stenlight for that trip.
So oh, cool. Nice. All right. Well, I'm sure it wasn't. It's not his only one.
No, it wasn't. But that, like, yeah, it was like I was still a little baby caver. And so he was like, you want, like, you can borrow a Sten for the trip. I'm like, really?
Was that at the time when that was the light?
That was the light. Yeah, that was the light. And I do remember because 2 years later, because around like very quickly after that, that's when the Scurrians came out.
Yeah.
And Bill Still bought Erin a Scurrian.
Yeah.
Just they didn't have anything. So she went from this stinky little Chinese light to like a Scurrian.
What do you use now?
Me?
Yeah.
So I had an Aspelio, but it got stolen. So right now I just got a Rudnora.
Oh, okay. Man, your Aspelio got stolen. Where? How? What? If anyone's listening and knows what happened, let's get it back.
Yeah, I had because of all the whole WNS thing, when I went up to Wind, I had this big debate of like my main kit, do I take it with me and keep it in storage or do I store it in Phoenix? And I stored it at a friend's house and someone broke in and took all my caving gear.
If only they knew.
June, I don't care about that.
If only they knew. I know, but it's if only they knew. Should we talk about the broken leg? I know it's caving. I know it's not really caving, but this is that sounded harrowing.
Okay, so it was supposed to. So that's the other fun thing is that I was supposed to be caving that week. So I had like our fall break, I really wanted to go on to one of those Grand Canyon trips. And I talked to Tobin and Tobin was like, oh, I need help with this arc survey. There'll be hikes. There'll be caves in the Grand Canyon. Come with me, help me. And then the trip last minute got canceled. And I was like, man, I'm not caving. I'm not anything. I'm not even doing any of this Grand Canyon stuff. I am bummed. And one of my friends from Texas had moved to Phoenix, and he was like, I'm looking for a climbing partner to do this trad climb. No one really wants to do it with me. Devra, you like spicy things. And I'm like, yeah, I like spicy things. And it's Oak Creek Spire, which is a beautiful spire out in Sedona. It was my first time climbing in Sedona, and it has its own quality of rock. It is...
And it's one of these classic looking, like, Southwest, red stone spire things. Like, it's the kind of thing you'd see in a movie.
Yeah, exactly. So if you like all those beautiful, like, Coyote Roadrunner films, those spires, that's what you're seeing with those rocks that fall. That's what, you know, it's that rock is just like that. So it is. It is, it's spicy because that rock is not, like, if you fall in the wrong place, that blows, like, into, like, that rock blows. And so we're doing this track climb, and, you know, depending on who talked to, 9+, 10-, and I have tiny hands, and it's kind of wide, so it was awkward. Anyway, we get it's known for being a double spire summit. You summit one spire, you walk across the kind of the mesa, the top of it, and then you do a jump. And then you summit the second spire, and it's about a 2 meter jump. It's more of like a dynamic step.
Okay.
And then you kind of frog. It's not like you're on a ledge. You actually are, you frog onto the like a jug onto a face. But below that part is terrible quality rock. So if you're the lead, it's okay. You swing back to good quality rock. But if you're the follow and you fall and there's too much slack, you can see the refrigerator below that wants to break off.
Okay, so I'm not terribly familiar with climbing, but when you're dealing with that quality of rock, I mean, what are you doing? Are you setting multiple protections in case of the rock crumbling? Okay.
Yeah, so it's a trad route. You know, some parts are good and some parts you're just like, there's no point in placing. That's just going to be worse.
It's just going to tear out if you fall. Wow.
Yeah. This is so Sedona. So anyway, my partner, who's over 6 foot tall, does the jump and he jumps. And he's like, oh, okay, I jumped a little hard, just kind of warning you. And I should have like taken that more to heart. But I'm like, okay, you're more athletic than me. You're a lot taller than me. I am not going to think about this too much because I will chicken out. So I just go for it and I perfectly land just right to basically pop my foot off my leg.
Ah.
I broke both my tibia and fibula.
Oh.
And luckily I wore socks that day. And I think that's the only reason it wasn't a compound fracture, because you could actually see my bone underneath my skin.
Oh.
And and I'm like telling my partner to take. He's like, I got you. I'm like, you got me? And he's like, I got you. And I'm like, awesome. He's like, I'm like, I broke my foot. And he's like, what? I'm like, well, actually, really, my ankle. And he's like, what? And I'm like, yeah. He's like, what? Are you serious? I'm like, yeah. And he's like, how do you know? I'm like, well, it's kind of just flapping.
Oh, no.
And he's like, what do you want to do? And I'm like, okay, can you like lock me in? Can you like clove hitch me in? And we'll just kind of do like a counterbalance system and we'll kind of figure this out. And I'm going to, while you like attach me to the anchor, I'm going to call this in. I had the pack, so I had my cell phone with me, and on the top of a spire, 300 feet in the middle of nowhere, Sedona, I had service.
Like decent service? Good enough decent to call 911, I guess.
Yeah, I did. And like, wow. It was super cute. The like dispatcher, I'm like, hi, you know, my name is Deborah Heyer. And I told them my age and all this. I'm now Oak Creek Spire and I've just broken my leg. And they're like, awesome. Well, we have a great GPS point for you. This is good.
They knew exactly where you are.
They knew exactly where I was. Yeah. It apparently, like, I think they got the call in 3 or 4 o'clock, and I was on the ground by 5:30.
Wow.
Yeah. So they got a helicopter. I was short called out, and me and my partner. So he had some rescue training. I had a little rescue training through caving, actually. So we both had a couple of stuffer. So extra prussic and things like that. So we can make a haul system. He came down to me. We get him on the other side. You make a haul system and you make a catch, la, 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 la. We get him over. We build an anchor. I put myself in a soft split. And I am just sitting there, this top of the spire, leg propped up, soft split. Like when this guy jumps out, comes over with the helicopter and kind of pops out. He's like, hi, are you okay? I'm like, yeah, you know, sorry, I broke my leg. They're like, they didn't even take me to a trauma one. So apparently I was supposed to go to a trauma one, but I wasn't presenting with enough pain.
Okay. That was going to be part of my next question. Like, what was pain management like? I mean, it seemed like you were fairly calm. You're like working to solve the problem with your partner. And in the meantime, like if it were me, I'd just be screaming the whole time.
Well, it's one of those things. If you keep things in line, it's good. And I got lucky, I guess, 2 years before I had dislocated my elbow in Taiwan on a climbing accident. And I had to speak Chinese with a dislocated elbow, which is probably the hardest, most difficult thing I've ever done in my whole entire life.
Ah, okay.
Self-rescuing, not as hard as speaking Chinese in a dislocated elbow.
Oh my gosh.
Just to let you know.
So they get you on the ground. And then they take it and everything's cool.
Yeah, it was super cool because it's a short haul. So if you're not familiar, like the they come in. So this guy comes out of the helicopter. They, you know, put a harness on me and they put a harness on you.
So they didn't use what you were wearing at the time. Yeah. I'm sure it's a different application.
It's a different harness. Yeah. And they put a cable. I already had my helmet on, so they thought that was great. And the guy goes to me, he's like, do you have sunnies? And I'm like, huh? He's like, sunglasses. I'm like, no. He's like, well, look out because this is going to be a view. And it was sunset in Sedona. I am like hanging 20 feet below a helicopter in the skies right below me, keeping my legs supported. So pain management, no big deal. And I'm like, wow, this is really pretty.
Amazing. Amazing. I've always wondered what that sort of thing was like. Okay, so what year?
Oh my goodness, I think 2016.
So 2016. So when were you able to do anything again? When were you fully healed?
Oh man, I had three surgeries. So I didn't walk at all. I was in load bearing for at least 3 months, and then I kind of started being able to like put some weight on it. And then I had a second surgery, and then I couldn't do it again for 3 months because like they had to screw both my legs together. I like my bones together get support. So pretty much a year later is when I started kind of caving again. That's where actually like a lot of my more fun trips comes in, is me seeing what I could do, what being in a cave was like. And it was, you know, not trusting my body the same way. And so I went to Chiricahua Crystal, I think was one of my first real caves going in. Cause there's a couple little, cool, let me get back to the environment. But it was like where I was stemming and actually having to weight that ankle in that way.
Mm-hmm. And, so it wasn't necessarily like a tsunami of caving where you're like making up for lost time. You kind of eased back into it a little bit.
Yeah, I mean, because my body, like I had been pretty much sick the whole time I came back to the States. So I was sick on top of having this broken ankle, but I didn't know that. I didn't know that at that time. I couldn't really differentiate one pain from another.
Oh, okay. This was the...
I got diagnosed with ulcerative colitis. I actually came back, I think, from a Lech trip. No, I at least came back from Carlsbad. I don't remember if I... And started work and then basically wound up in the hospital for a week. Man. And I got diagnosed and they're like, oh yeah, so yeah, your whole entire colon's ulcerated. And I'm like, oh, that's new.
Oh, great. Does that impact caving at all? Or is it just, you just got to be mindful of your diet, really?
No, I was malnourished. I was really sick. I started caving again very slowly. That's why I had to do day trips, is because the amount of time from when I was doing good or okay to bad was a very quick turnover. So I would be good, good, good. And 2 days later, just be like calling the doctor, debating if I need to go back to the hospital.
Oh my gosh, man.
So it took a while to find a treatment. It took a long time. It even actually took a while to get fully diagnosed because even with the hospital, they were still kind of, there was a couple other pieces. They were like, we think you have this, but I had so many other associated symptoms that they had to rule out like a bunch of other stuff. So I actually got very, very lucky because I had friends within the caving community who also dealt with autoimmune disorders. One of them didn't have it, like had the same disorder, but not to the degree that I did. But I got to hear, like, he helped me a lot with the struggles and talking, like, that forgiveness of saying no to trips or backing out of trips or taking it easy or being slow or, like, not being able to perform at the same level that I used to and, like, being okay with that. So he was, like, a very good, like, mentor to that piece and kind of almost like my caving sponsor, I guess.
That's always a good thing to have.
And then I have another friend who also has autoimmune that severely has impacted their life and just trying to figure out your identity when identifying with being that proficient and having that taken away from you.
Yeah. Yeah. No kidding. Are you at any, I don't know, specifics about,
I'm in remission. Is that what you're referring to?
Well, yeah, I guess either that, or is there a danger of it getting any worse? Do you know how to mitigate it or prevent that from happening?
So it took me 3 years to finally find a treatment that worked. I'm really lucky that it took that little of time and I got to keep all my internal organs. So that was definitely a danger. That was a plus. Starting to be a thing.
Wow.
But so I'm in remission. And so that's really awesome. And it's just been a great journey into now, like, can I get back up to that level? Like, it comes a question mark versus before, like, it felt like it was off the table. But I did do that soul searching. If I can't do expeditions anymore, is that okay? I did.
No kidding.
And it's really cool to think about why do I go to these places? Why do I go caving? What if this is taken away from me? Can I still feel fulfillment and still be myself? And I realized I did it for the furthering of knowledge I am that cheesy person of the only reason I can see so far, far as I stand on the shoulder of giants. And I like the idea of being that giant below. And that's why I became a teacher. I want people to see farther than me. I want to
And that's a great, in a world like the caving world, that's a great attitude to have, I feel like.
Yeah, I don't have to be the person who gets to go to all the places, but I want to make sure, those experiences can be had by others. And if I can't do it, I want to make sure someone else can. Mm. What does that need to happen? And making sure it's still there for people to experience those things. That's also another piece is when we start talking about us as cavers and our impact on these environments. And that checks and balance system of going in and to finding what beautiful resources they are, making sure we know what it is, but also that cost benefit analysis of conserving it it's hard. It's hard to figure out what that balance is.
Yeah. You nailed it because I think about that all the time. We talk about conservation. We talk about not abusing caves. We talk about visiting caves in the same breath. And
yeah.
If people who don't know it think about it too much and they start asking about that, you've got to really rehearse that answer.
And you have to do a little bit of soul searching too, of what that answer is for you.
Yeah, exactly.
And I do think it's different in different places. And I think there is a regionality difference because of that, because our impact looks a little different in different systems. I mean, one of the things we talk about is TAG all the time. TAG is the caves that are huge. They're open to the environment. There's a lot of interactions with the surface. Our impact is going to be very, very different than these caves that have been closed off from the surface, where the microbiome is super sensitive, where there's these microclimates that completely affect the microflora. Those are two completely different stories.
Mm-hmm.
You can tell I'm a teacher.
No, and I love that. I love the way you communicate about that. Well, and along those lines, you were a biological technician at Wind Cave, which is that's a unique
stuff,
environment.
But I did the surface things. So I wasn't doing cave stuff. I was doing surface stuff.
Yeah, but you were cave adjacent.
I was cave adjacent, which is actually a great way to have a job as a caver.
Yeah.
I think being cave adjacent, because then you're caving, is not your job, especially in the national park system, because you think being a physical science technician is the best, or being a cave manager is the best. But what ends up happening is you can't necessarily do the caving you want to do when you want to do it, because it's your job. And the dictations of resource management, and it's a little different. But if you're cave adjacent... You're there, you're in the area, you have that access, but you don't necessarily have some of the limitations and also the politics that goes into having going into a cave everyday job.
Mm, okay.
So I think you can appreciate the national park person in me. You can appreciate the resource more.
Okay. Yeah. There's that word, resource.
So you
mentioned politics, and you weren't necessarily talking caving politics, but I always like to ask people if we get around to it. When I first was sort of introduced to this idea of caving politics, and there's some divisiveness within the caving world of, does this group share enough with this group, or should this group share more things, things like that. And I am not a project caver. I'm not a serious caver. I'm a recreational caver, and I'm also a father of toddlers, so I don't get to go very often. And I do get to talk with plenty of cavers, through this podcast, which I'm very, very thankful for. So I always am curious to know more about that from serious cavers like yourself. What do you think of the whole caving politics thing?
Ooh, I mean, that's...
That's a big question, and it's a little vague, I know.
Yeah, and it's such a... It's interesting, and so I am lucky, privileged, one of those words, because, you know, I have caved in a lot of different areas. I have lived in a lot of different areas, and so it's you know, caving politics and concerns are very different by that locality, and I do usually come with the idea of, when I come to a place, you honor those ethics.
Right. And it changes from place to place.
And it changes from place to place. So, and like as an outsider, you need to learn those ethics before you come in. And so, you know, that whole, and I do this, you know, as somebody who's lived in different places, lived in different countries, as a Weigel Wren, as a foreigner coming in, an outside person. You have to learn the way people talk. You have to learn about where their values are. And it's a little different. And there's a reason for it. So there is always a reason for their way. Mm-hmm. And it's a way. It's not necessarily the way. And I think when it comes to politics, that's what why we have those conflicts, is we get this an idea of this is the way versus a way. And we don't look about that hierarchy of values. Mm-hmm. So it's not that we don't value, like, generally we value all the same things. It's how we, where do we place those values? What's our, like, what do we place first? Which is the thing we value the most? And that's where I find most people, when we talk about politics, it's that order change.
Mm. Then am I interpreting this correctly in saying that sometimes the problems that you hear about, it seems like maybe from what you're saying that they arise from people coming into a situation and not respecting the values of that area?
Well, sometimes it's not even knowing. It's making an assumption. So I don't even think that's like the assumption, because we, I think as cavers, kind of assume some, we have inherently all the same value in the same value order. And I do think it's very true that for the most part, that our values are definitely overlapped. It's a very large, like that center part of the Venn diagram is very large. It's the, as I said, it's the order of that. And that, it's harder to communicate.
Yeah.
Because like someone's like, well, you aren't valuing conservation. The other person's like, yes, I am. But they're putting it maybe second over safety.
Oh, okay.
And somebody's putting conservation for, you know, so that's where you are starting to, you hear. And like some people are like, well, actually it's equal and it's more of a cost benefit analysis. And that looks different too, especially safety. What is acceptable risk for people is very, very different and changes over time and changes over area and changes per day. And so that, and communicating that is very difficult.
What I really appreciate is I'm very thankful that I asked the question, because you're walking me through this in a very, in a really, really nice way. And I'm glad for it. You are the education division chief for the NSS.
Yep. And I'm the education program manager for NCRI. So I have my NCRI hat versus my NSS hat. So,
well, like, and they both say teacher on it, which is great.
Yeah. And yeah, educator. Right. So, you know, so when it comes to caving, that's usually my NSS hat. And when it comes to like caves and karst, that's usually my NCRI hat. And there is some overlap. Sometimes I kind of have to wear one forward and one backwards and kind of like, you know, do like the cool kid things. And there is some overlap, but that's kind of how I have to kind of look at it that way is, okay, to define those roles. I'm very big with conversations and making sure we have the same definitions.
Mm-hmm. What are your goals then with that? Like, what are you tasked to do as the education division chief of the NSS, or with your role with NCRI? I mean, like, what are you doing now, and what do you hope to accomplish in the years to come?
Okay, so those are great questions. I have a whole presentation for that.
Because that's a lot of self-starter stuff, you know what I mean? And I'm a terrible self-starter. You give me a big title like that, and I'm going to stand there going, and I'm not going to know what to do with myself.
And honestly, when I first started for the NSS, I did. I was just like, someone's like, oh, we'll help you. And like, and I was like, and when?
Yeah, and yeah. I wouldn't believe that for a second. If anyone's, and, not just the NSS, but anybody. I mean, we're going to help you, we'll help you.
And it was like, so what do I do with this? And they're like, anything you want. And I'm like,
And so I had you got to draw some lines.
So I had, yeah, and I had to do my own definitions and break it down of like, I wish I, like, part of me like wants to pull up my PowerPoint so I can actually tell you all neatly. Because for the NSS, I did that. I like, okay, as the education division chief, here is my mission. Here are the things, you know, I want, like, that I put under my purview based off what I read in the BOG manual, based off what our committees are, and went through it and started breaking that down into actionable items. And you kind of had to. So, like, my big dream for, I guess, the NSS is, like, when people have a caving question, they go to the NSS. They're like, I want to go in the cave. And I want to shine a spotlight to all the work that everyone else is doing. So it's like, okay, here's the central hub. If I don't know where to find this information, I go to the NSS, and the NSS is like, actually, yeah, SCCI has this thing. Oh, yeah, KWI, they have this great thing. Oh, NCRI has this thing. Oh, you should go to look at this grotto. They have this great program. You know, that. But that's how I view the NSS. We should be this nexus of information.
Okay.
When it comes to, and that's, I guess, my personal vision is that not necessarily we have to do all things, but we are connected to those things, and we and shine a light to the things that other people are doing.
Mm. And a lot is happening in the NSS right now. I mean, there the website is being updated. It seems like there is a shift in priorities, which is in I think a very good way. It seems like interest, I don't, from my perspective, I haven't seen numbers or anything, but it just seems like interest is growing, and it seems like there it's growing in complexity as well.
Right. And so, I mean, I'm kind of in the back of that. So I don't even know how to like how much do I even share of like all the things that are kind of going on? Cause like part of it is it's been going on for years in my end. so I'm right. Like, what I'm like, what are people seeing? What is trickling down to outside? Because like, so for instance, like even the, like the Vertical Training Commission, like that has been percolating for over a year in my world.
Wow. Yeah.
So that's kind of the thing is like, so when people talk about it, I'm like, where are you at? Like I've and that's kind of the weird novel being in the back end of things and the back end of the caving politics or, you know, when it comes, as I said, to NCRI, it's the same thing. It's kind of a similar situation. Like we also have a new website out. We're making new educational pieces and trying to put that out kind of like having a social media presence in like more of a meaningful way, which is kind of new for me. So I'm Amanda Willis. Thank you. Shout out.
There you go. Okay.
So doing those pieces, it's hard and like coming up with a game plan of like, okay, what does the foundational work look like? You know, for me, at least with the NSS, it was going, what are all those committees? Cause that actually, when I first took that position, I had no idea what my committees were. I had to look that up. No one told me that. No surprise.
Yeah. You know, hey, when you're talking about a huge volunteer organization, almost all volunteer organization, I mean, yeah, it's going to take some time to define all that.
And it took me a year to kind of like wrap that around my brain. And then basically Adam Weaver became AVP. And I was told by Ben Tobin, Tobin's like, Adam's now at AVP. And I'm like, I have that boy's number. I'm calling him. And he's like, oh, you're the DEFRA. So what have you been doing for the past year? And I'm like, let me show you. But I didn't have like resources or the blessing to do anything. And that was the thing is I didn't know the mechanisms and how the NSS worked. None of that was like written anywhere. And so that has been a large piece of what I did in the education division. It was like writing those pieces down of like, this is how all that works. And that way, when people have a question, I go, here you go.
Yeah. Can you give me what would be, I guess, maybe not an all-encompassing example, but something just sort of some kind of an example of something that you have done as education division chief of the NSS, some kind of write-up, some kind of literature, some kind of flyer thing you might hand out as part of an outreach sort of a thing. What is it exactly?
So I'll tell you about our latest stuff. So like, first off, this is the first year that the NSS is participating in Bat Week.
Oh, wow. What? Really?
Yep.
Okay.
First time. So that's happening.
Yeah.
This is also the first time we've participated with Earth Science Week. ever. As the NSS,
man.
We put a flyer together. We got out our information for our grants, for Spelio guests, for all the educational caving flyers that we make. We put like QR codes and have a flyer in a Earth Science Toolkit. Dave Decker, who is our AGI liaison, donated to the NSS so that people, like any teacher who wants that toolkit, we can ship it to them because he's donated money to make sure that happens.
That's
so
great.
We have a bunch of them. We're working on, like, we just finished. I'm waiting for, like, getting the last pieces of feedback for activity books. So the CPN, that was kind of Adam's baby. But the educational pieces, that's been, like, Sharon Weaver, who is the Environmental Education Committee. So having that actually be a committee again, that's part of that. So that's another piece, working in conjunction with the NCRC to do that that safety series. That was another piece. I know the contentious thing was, so the login for the members, the FAQ that went along with that, that was us. Hmm. I'm like literally going through what have we done? Apparently you haven't read any BOG reports for the last 2 years.
Well, I mean, no, I haven't. But then again, I'm not terribly involved. So how does that parallel to NCRI then?
That work, basically, it's like almost what, like that style of work is basically what I do now for NCRI, but now I get paid. But it's
right.
More, but not, so now, for instance, I'm making specifically cave and karst educational pieces, working on a cave and karst curriculum that hopefully will be aligned to the so the karst studies program that's at New Mexico Tech. So like align, like vertically aligning that by pedagogy standards. So like all the knowledge and skills and aligning that to their program, going and doing educational pieces for math, for history that are related, like using data from caves or experiences from caves. Cause there's a lot of research and shows that there's a higher level of efficacy of learning if you can connect it to something real, to connect it to a story, to connect it to something you can see and experience that's not just this hypothetical, you know, like everything, like you're treating almost learning like an apprenticeship, like, oh, cool, let's go out and measure dilution of a dye in water, like, or talk about it or experience that or observe it and like see what dilution actually means versus like this hypothetical thing that you're just doing, like doing calculations of.
Mm-hmm. And I appreciate that you are doing this because you are an educator. And when you were in the classroom, you were like a sixth grade science teacher for a while.
Oh man. Okay. So
I'm sure you've done a lot.
Taught a lot.
Yeah.
My last job was a sixth grade science teacher. So I've taught chemistry. I've taught physics. I've taught conceptual chemistry. I've taught bio. I've taught Algebra 2, geometry. I've even taught music theory.
Wow. Okay. Curious. So I guess where I'm going with that is you are creating materials with educators in mind. You know,
right.
That part of your job is creating
yes.
materials with educators in mind. As an educator yourself, had something like this come down the pipeline, you are designing it, I'm guessing, in your current position to appeal to educators so that if they got this in the mail or if they got this email and saw it, they would want to use it.
Yeah. And that's, and it's hard too, because it looks different. And honestly, let's be real, how education looks now this year is very different than how it looked 2 years ago.
Oh my gosh. Of course.
And there's a lot of different pressures. And so trying to, you know, luckily I'm still tapped into that population. So going, what do you need? And that's the other thing is like, especially with caves, is a lot of people think, oh, cool, let's do a about caves lesson. And I'm like, no, let's do a math lesson because that's what people need.
Yeah.
You know, how it's so hard to make a lot of math concepts accessible and fun, especially to the younger, like not the young grades, like kinder, like elementary school, it's great. You still, because you're doing with number sense. And so you can have a lot of manipulatives. But when you start getting to some of the basic algebra, there sometimes can be a disconnect in the way we teach math. And so going back to, like, how do we use that math and connecting it to the physics, but also connecting to that it's a way of describing an area, a way of describing the situation, and coming back to that and showing how that's done at a way, like scaling down to that level. And that's hard for a lot of people to, like, scale down.
Yeah, I would imagine. To kind of get back to the timeline, and I'm not asking you to make up work for yourself or anything like that, but if you could see what you would like for this division of the NSS, the education division, to sort of become or to sort of look like in the years to come and maybe accomplish, I don't know, what does that look like for you?
Oh, that is a good question. 'Cause now, as I said, I have two hats on that, right?
Yeah.
And so for one is doing more partnerships, like for like the for teachers, for instance, like we have an education grant that is very much underutilized. That I feel like for teachers to know that the NSS is a source of information when it comes to caves and caving. I want them to know that NCRI is a source of information when it comes to earth science, to geoscience, to karst, and that I'm like to put my do my mean girls impression. It's like, I want to make karst a thing. I don't know if you remember. Stop making fetch a thing. I'm like, yeah, I want to make karst a thing.
You want to make karst a thing. And I'm with you on that. I'm with you on that. Anytime you say that word, people are like, what? What is that? And then you got to explain it.
Yeah, so if you can imagine, you know, like that scene, so let's stop making karst a thing. It's never going to be a thing. I'm like going to have all my Florida cave divers behind me with their tanks on, and all the Texas peeps being like,
oh no, we're making it a thing.
We're making it a thing. So if you can imagine that posse, it's like, because Florida, right? That they know that word. Texas, they know that word. I like in more normal lexicon, because they see that, you know, on the streets, literally there's signs that says, you know, the Edwards Aquifer recharge zone.
Exactly.
Yeah. And people are like, Keskese, what is that? I don't know. Yeah. Like, so there's those questions that, you know, that's been asked, but people forget, like 20% of the United States cursed, you know, a lot of our drinking water. Guess where it comes from? All those carbonate rocks.
The entire state of Missouri.
Yeah. I mean, you have a whole entire cities that are there. All their water is aquifer water.
Yeah. It matters.
It matters. And like letting people know that interconnectedness between us and the land and our effect with their environment. And it's, but, you know, people don't realize that connection hasn't been made to them, of like that cave down the street from you that is connected to that glass of water you're drinking.
Totally. Directly.
Yeah.
You know,
let's not throw tires in them. Can we not do that?
Yeah. Let's just not do that. Okay. Yeah. So what is, what's coming up next as far as caving trips and projects? What are you involved with?
Caving trips. So I just moved. So that makes it like more
from
difficult.
Where to where?
Okay. So I've moved around. I think I've moved 8 times in the last 2 years.
Actually. Wow. So, holy crap.
Yeah.
In pandemic? That sounds like a nightmare.
Yeah. And I've had like 3 different jobs too. So like 4 different jobs. Sorry. 4. So, you know, I went from teaching to a biological technician. So that was plant. I was veg crew. So plant work. And then I helped a friend deal with her munchkins. So I was tetty to a 1-year-old and a 4-year-old.
Adorable.
Which is its own job.
Yeah,
you know.
Yeah. I'm a father of a 2-year-old and a 4-year-old. It's a whole thing.
Yeah. You know, so I was tetty, or I am tetty. And then I moved, and then I started with a physical science technician at Alma Paez. So mapping and inventorying caves, and now I'm back to education, which I love. I love education. It's like leaving education is like the worst divorce you can break up bad. You know, you want to like the you know, put on the sweats and eat all the ice cream, Ben and Jerry style.
I would imagine. Well, it's a calling. It's not a, you know, you're called to it. You're called to it. Most people who stick with it anyway.
Yeah, I think that's a true statement, but I think it's such a dangerous statement is because people forget that as an educator, you have a skill set.
Yeah.
And there's, especially in the US, there's such a disconnect that if you are an educator, you have multiple skill sets. You know your content, you know all the academics of that, and then you have the pedagogy. And so that's its own skill set. And that, you know, and to find someone who can do both and then connect it. And people forget. They think, oh, cool, if you know the content, go.
That's not the same thing. If you can know all the content, but if you can't communicate it, that is, we've all had professors and teachers like that, where they know everything, but they cannot get it into your brain the way it's living in theirs.
And it's interesting because for the business world, we don't mind paying for a lot of money for a service for someone to train us that has that Venn diagram that meets both of that criteria knows the how to be a good trainer and knows content. Man. We have no problem like throwing out the dough for that when we're dealing with the business world, right? Mm. But when it comes down to other educational pieces, it's like, where is this disconnect coming from?
Mm. Yeah.
I don't know. That's my politics right there.
Yeah. So where are you? What's the next trip? Where are you going?
Where is the next trip? So right now, I know I'm helping with it sounds like a receptivity study in Bracken Bat Cave. I'm supposed to help do a ridge walk in like the Gypcap area. But that's kind of like amorphous sometime this month. I haven't gotten a date on that. And then I still have two cave maps I need to finish for, which I guess is kind of, I need to finish for Elma. So I think that's really all that's on my plate right now, because I've only been here for 2 months, 3 months, 3 months, two, not even, it'll be 3 months next week.
Is there you've been to Lech. It sounds like you've done an awful lot. Where do you want to go?
Oh man. Well, I still haven't gone to the Grand Canyon.
Oh yeah, you gotta do some of that.
Yeah, so that is the whole reason I moved back to the States. Tobin, I blame you. I know you're in Kentucky right now. Actually, that's a lie. He's in Portland right now. He was like, "Yeah, these Grand Canyon trips," and I'm like, "Man, those sound awesome. I like this idea of an air bath. I hate heights, but it's funny because I hate the sensation of falling. I am not a fan of heights, but if I'm on rope, I'm like very focused on what I'm doing. It's very strange.
No, but I feel you. Well, it's like caving too. I mean, it focuses your movements. It focuses everything. It's like caving to me is like, it's like a meditation, because if you're not paying attention to every little thing that's going on, you might have problems.
Yeah. I think we've all kind of, maybe not all of us, but I've definitely ping ponged down, a canyon before and landed and had to go, answered, are you hurt with just my pride? You know, I've been there.
Yeah. So many of us have been there. Well, here we are at an hour. Is there anything that you wanted to make sure we covered? We jumped around a lot, but I loved it. This was marvelous. I appreciate it so much. Thank you for your time.
So I mean, I guess from my point of view, it's like, so we talk. I mean, we spent a lot of time talking about education, which you can tell is very important to me.
Mm-hmm.
And that there's so much in general that we learn from caving. And that's kind of one of my going back to what is kind of part of my vision, things I want to explore more, is that idea of if you teach caving about caves, if you teach conservation, what else are you actually teaching and making those connections? There's inherent things that we do. If we teach people to cave, you know, when we talk about situational awareness and how that connects to rescue, when we talk about even the most layman caver has a basic understanding of geology.
Yeah.
And so starting to explore that idea of, you know, what do you learn? So if you teach a person to cave, what else do you learn?
Yeah. Just from being in that environment and noticing things that you wouldn't otherwise because you have never been in there.
And then with the Nikri hat on, it's like if you teach about why caves and karst are special, why we should care about that, what educational standards are you inherently meeting? And so those are like, those are my two different hats of like this idea of like, if I teach this, what else do you learn? And making that easy for people to see that connection, making it, because it's so intrinsic that people don't realize what they're learning. And that's kind of the part of the problem. Like when I was teaching science, kids were like, I don't know chemistry. That's just so foreign. I'm like, you've been doing chemistry every day. You ate, okay? You made breakfast. You brushed your teeth. You know, like you just don't know the academic language that's associated with it. You don't know the scientific culture that's associated with it. And karst itself is a very jargony discipline. And the vernacular is not necessarily accessible because it's so derived for so many different languages. I mean, even the word karst is I think it's Slovenian, if I remember correctly.
Yeah, yeah, something like that. Eastern Europe.
Yeah, and so you have certain words that are like Tianqin is a Chinese word, right? And that is a specific geologic feature. I didn't realize cenote actually is a defined geologic feature. So, I was wondering, like, what is the difference between a cenote and a sinkhole? And there actually is a difference between a cenote and a sinkhole, which I did not know until very recently. But I think I learned the word cenote before I learned the word, like, had ever heard sinkhole. And so those, I guess, those are pieces. And, like, it's interesting how much we learn is like this, even language acquisition. It's like I learned Spanish through caving.
Yeah, yeah.
Very terrible Spanish. Let me get you right. Like it's very much arriba, abajo, dentro. You
know? And there are a lot of I know a lot of cavers personally who have done the same thing. You know,
I mean that's my caving in China made the idea of moving to Taiwan. Not only, like, because it was scary. Everyone's like, oh, you're so brave. You left the country. You moved to a country. You didn't know the language. And I was like, no, it was still scary. It just seemed more doable. and so I learned that. That's why I learned Chinese is because I lived in a country that, in a place, I lived in a place in Taiwan where no one really spoke any English. And that's, you know, and I wanted to be able to travel in China by myself.
Yeah. It only makes sense.
Yeah. Or really, let's be real. I just wanted to eat.
Right? You wanted to eat?
That is a major drive on learning a language is.
Well, and eat well, too, you know, because you could find food anywhere. But what are they eating? And
like jala, hanla. Come on. All the spice. That's what I want.
Load it up.
Load it up. That's pretty, yeah, that is actually one of the first things I learned in Chinese is how to say spicy and keep on adding.
I want my nose to bleed.
I like to tear, not hiccup. I want to tear up and like get the decongestant and not hiccup.
Yeah,
like
yeah,
that,
yeah.
That fine line. That needs to be a singular word. I don't know who our lexicon humans are, but somebody needs to make that word because that should be. I should have one word to define that level of spicy.
Well, Deborah, you know the more I talk with people who are really involved, the more hope I'm kind of flooded with for the future of the NSS in the things that we're doing and the focus that we have, and in speaking with you just now, you know that. That has just gone up even further. And I just appreciate what you're doing. And I know that people listening to this are going to appreciate it as well. So thanks for sharing your caving story. And also, thanks for doing what you're doing.
Well, thank you. I appreciate it. And appreciate you having this podcast and like making it such a beautiful platform to communicate with people. Because that's really what is going on is how we communicate with people now is very different than 5 years ago and the expectation of accessibility of knowledge and conservation of knowledge has definitely changed a lot in the last, honestly, even 5 years. Like in 10 years, it's even bigger, but the ability for knowledge to be conserved has definitely grown. And I think it's something that's very, very meaningful and should be done in a very purposeful way. And I think this is an outlet to do that.
Yeah. Just wait till you see how much we get figured out in the next 5 years.
Oh, God, I'm scared.
It's going to be your job.
Yeah, that's my job, right? And it's like, so I'm supposed to make that 5-year goal and supposed to somehow break it down to make it attainable. That doesn't sound scary at all.
Yeah, you've done a lot scarier stuff, that's for sure. Thanks, Deborah.
Nice talking to you, Matt.
You never know how things are going to go. You never know how a talk is going to go, how someone's going to be. I was so jazzed after that talk with Deborah. Because she was so nice and, well, you heard it. It's always nice when someone's excited to talk to you, you know? And someone who has a background in communication and education the way she does. And so, I don't know. Deborah, you were a great guest, and I appreciate it. And thank you for listening. We do this every month on the first of every month. And do I know who's coming next month? No. Do I have some ideas? Yeah. But I can assure you I'll have somebody in December. And if you'd like to come on, or if you'd like to nominate someone, recommend someone to talk to, you can always send me an email address. I'm in the NSS directory, but it's alpineproductions@gmail.com. alpineproductions@gmail.com. And I appreciate it. And if you are looking for someone to present to your grotto, I go to bed pretty early, but I'll stay up for you. Hit me up that same way. I've got a presentation on the podcast I'd love to give. Of course, support the podcast by supporting our sponsors, past and present. Swego at swegogear.com. Get the best waterproof pack in caving. Organic Robot Designs, a screen printer, embroiderer. Is that a word? Doesn't matter. Charlie's the man. If you want t-shirts made for your grotto, give him a Google. Organic Robot Designs, or he's got an Etsy shop too. And he's got a bunch of pre-made caving-related designs, which you should really check out in the Etsy shop. And of course, our current sponsor, El Spelio. Get one of the best caving lights on the planet at elspelio.com. Expedition worthy, heavy duty. Caving knocks things around. This thing will keep on working. Elspelio.com. All right, I think that's it. Until next time, kill nothing but time.